Now, whenever we discuss Patanjali or Yoga Sutras, there is a small invocation to Patanjali that we always sing. Okay, so you can either close the eyes and listen to me, or you can read this along. Okay, and so either way, it's okay. Yogen chittasya paden vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. So that an invocation to sage Patanjali. And would you mind reading the English translation loud?
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, Patanjali
Mahabhashya,
and the impurities of the citta through his treatise. Is that treatise?
Yeah, treatise.
Treatise on yoga.
Okay, wonderful. So as you can see, Patanjali has been given credit for three sciences, so to say. The most important sciences, what are these? Impurities of the mind, body and the speech. that covers everything in life. Okay? And he is given credit for giving us the science and technology for everything. Okay, so is it fair to assume that you already have some introduction to the Yoga Sutras? And have you been covering the eight limbs of yoga? Mm-hmm. Are you done with that?
Mm-hmm. No. Not done with that.
Just getting started.
Yeah.
But you're at least familiar with the term eight limbs of yoga. Okay, very good. So again, you know, my job is to just kind of supplement whatever you have been learning and give you a little more background, a little more in-depth, I guess, understanding of what yoga is all about, as given to us by sage Patanjali. Okay. Now, Patanjali's time frame is not well known, as you probably have heard. You know, it's not clear when he was existent. And, most historians tend to believe that he was within 300 years of Buddha, plus or minus. So he was either before Buddha or after Buddha, but within that time frame. And the reason they tend to believe that is because many of the concepts presented by Patanjali are identical or very similar to those presented by Buddha in many ways. So one of them was influenced by the other. Which way? We don't know.
Could you spell that name? Could you spell that name?
Which one?
He's within 300 years of Buddha?
Buddha.
I'm not familiar. I'm sorry.
You don't know Buddha?
Buddha.
Oh, Buddha. I'm sorry. That's the pronunciation.
It's the accent.
Yes. Pardon me.
It's the accent.
Okay. So that's one of the things that you have to eventually learn, how to pronounce these Sanskrit words. Okay. But if you say Buddha, it doesn't mean anything. It's not the name of that person. The real name is Buddha. That means something.
And it's spelled the same that we spell it. B-U-D-D-H-A.
Yes, B-U-D-D-H-A. Okay. Buddha means one who is enlightened. That literally means that. But if you say Buddha, it means nothing. It's not a word in Sanskrit. I'm just being a little picky, but that's how it is. So, what Patanjali did was to give us what you can think of as the philosophy. But even more than philosophy, he gave us the psychology, terminology, methodology for the practice of yoga. Okay. He made it more than a philosophy, he made it a practice. And that's why he presented the 8 limbs of yoga, which are to be practiced, not philosophized. And the philosophy or the whole science of yoga that he presented is based on an even more ancient philosophy called the philosophy of Sankhya. Have you heard the term Sankhya? Okay. So that's the ancient philosophy, more ancient, more even older than yoga. And that's what the whole philosophy of yoga is based on. Sankhya is spelled as Sankhya. And I'll come to that Sankhya term a little bit later also. So in terms of Patanjali Yoga Sutras, as you know, there are 4 chapters in this text. Do you remember the names of these chapters?
Begins with the M, Samadhi.
First one is?
Samadhi.
Samadhi Pada. Very good. Yeah. And then second one? Okay, the name is Sadhana Pada. Sadhana Pada. The number 3 is Vibhuti Pada. Vibhuti. Okay. And the 4th chapter is called Kaivalya Pada. Kaivalya Pada. Okay. Samadhi is the state of the mind and also a practice. What is Samadhi? Samadhi is the state of the mind where the mind is completely absorbed in its own object of meditation. That's Samadhi. Which is, as you know, the 8 limbs of yoga, that's in terms of practice. When you say 8 limbs of yoga, that's practice. But what you get at the end of the 8 limbs of yoga is also the state of Samadhi. So the Samadhi is both a practice as well as the final state of the mind, which is our goal in the whole practice of yoga. That's the Samadhi Pada. It defines yoga, first of all, the very first chapter. It gives us the definition of what yoga is all about. And then it goes on to describe different states and stages of Samadhi. You know, it goes through many different stages of Samadhi. And finally reach the ultimate state of Samadhi, which is called the seedless. That's the very last sutra in chapter 1. Sutra number 53 or 4, whatever that is, which defines what is called the seedless samadhi. That means there is absolutely no seed, no object left, and it's the total silence at that point. Nothingness. 100% nothingness. Okay. The second chapter is called sadhana pada. The word sadhana means methodology, so to say. Sadhana means approach to doing something. How do you approach? So what are we interested in here is to understand what yoga is and what are the goals and objectives of yoga and how to get there. Okay, and that, all that is described in chapter 2. Okay? So chapter 2, actually it starts out with an explanation of suffering, or you can call it stress in the modern terminology. Okay, so it starts out with understanding of what stress is all about, suffering is all about, what causes it. It goes into a fair amount of discussion on the concept of karma theory. Does everyone know what karma is? Roughly. Okay. So it goes into karma theory. And from there on it starts discussing how to attain the goals of yoga. What causes, first of all, not to attain the goals of yoga. What is the impediments? And then eventually, how to get there. And then he says that by practicing these 8 limbs of yoga, you can get to the final goal of yoga, which is to attain the state of final liberation. Okay. Then the 3rd chapter goes much more in depth into the whole practice of meditation. And it also talks about what are the different supernormal or supernatural powers that one can attain through the practice of these very deep states of meditation. That's all in chapter 3. It's called the Vibhuti Pada. Vibhuti means supernormal powers. That's the word Vibhuti. Chapter 4 is called Kaivalya Pada, which is all about understanding in depth what is that final state of liberation, what it means, etc., etc. There's a little more in-depth understanding of the final state of liberation. Okay? So that's kind of the overall layout of this whole the text of Yoga Sutras. There's a total of 195 sutras. The word sutra means what?
Thread.
It's a thread. So it's threading all these different statements. People like to call them aphorisms. Okay, they are threaded together through these sutras. And by necessity, they have to be very, very cryptic, very brief, cryptic, almost totally non-understandable by themselves. Okay. The way these Sanskrit language is structured, you don't necessarily have to have a verb in every sentence. And apparently, you know, somebody was telling me the other day that they counted and there are only about 4 or 5 verbs in the entire 195 sutras. Because they have to be very, very cryptic. And why did they have to be cryptic?
I was going to ask you that.
So you can make your own meaning
now? No. So, because this whole knowledge of everything that was in the ancient days, there was no printing press. There was no writing instruments. There was nothing to write on. The only thing people could write on were leaves from big trees, you know, these big leaves from trees, and they could probably scribble something down. But then in the night, you know, and this is one of the stories that Yoga Sutra has, that Patanjali had somebody write it on a piece of a leaf or something, and at night a goat came and ate the leaf. Have you heard that? Okay. So they had to make, it was essential that if it's a sutra, it had to be very, very brief and cryptic, because only when it is short and brief, you can memorize it. And when you can memorize it, then you can transmit through oral transmission. If it is too verbose, nobody can memorize it. So they had to be very brief. But it also, at the same time, made it extremely difficult to understand what the author might have meant. So you needed the help of a commentator. Without a commentary, impossible. You cannot understand these sutras. So the most ancient commentary is written by a guy named Vyasa, V-Y-A-S-A. Now, many people believe, many historians believe that he was sort of a compatriot of Patanjali. So they knew each other. Some even go to the extent of saying that Patanjali himself changed his name to Vyasa later and wrote his own commentary or something like that. Okay. Now, that commentary has also become a very canonical form of the text. People almost like to read it together. Because without that commentary, nothing can be understood. Today, in the modern times, there are dozens and dozens of commentaries. But almost everybody, without exception, has to fall back on that commentary by Vyasa so that they can understand what Patanjali might have meant. Because apparently only Vyasa knew his mind. That's it. Okay? So, that's just by way of background now, you know, so you can understand kind of the historicity of the whole context of the Yoga Sutras. So, what we want to do is to kind of go through sutra by sutra, in the first chapter, at least the first few sutras, and then we're not going to go through every single sutra. There are 195. We'll probably go through maybe 20 total or something. But that should give us an idea of what it's all about. And in the past, Dharma has mentioned that I really don't need to go through the eight limbs of yoga in any depth at all, because you guys are doing it separately. So I will not touch that. So I'll touch other aspects of the text which are significant. Okay? So the very first sutra in chapter 1 is this one. So in this one it says that in Sanskrit, I'm going to read briefly some of these. I'm going to read in Sanskrit also, so at least you know the sound of the Sanskrit language. Okay, so this one it says Atha Yoga Anushasanam. Now, you know, each one of these words has a lot of meaning in it, and commentators take their own time, spend their own time in explaining all these things. I have a commentary by somebody by the name, last name is Arya, okay, and he has spent 47 pages of his text on the commentary of this sutra, number one, 47 pages, okay. So what it says is that here now, Atha means here and now, Yoga Anushasanam. Yoga, I'm going to, it's now time for me to explain the discipline or the whole knowledge of yoga. That's the first sutra. The word Atha means now and here. So people, you know, these commentators have their own understanding of what that might have meant. Why did he say now and here? Okay. So this, they do go into all kinds of explanation. It could mean that now is the right time. I have given you all the other information. I have given you all the other knowledge about various background information, you know, different scriptures, maybe Vedas and Upanishads and everything you're familiar with. But now it's time to explain to you what yoga is all about. It also means that, look, you guys are qualified now. At this point, you have graduated to a point where you are now eligible to understand the concept of yoga. It also might mean that at this point, I am qualified to give you the knowledge of yoga. Okay, so commentators, they've given all these multiple explanations. Now is the time. Now you are in this human birth. If you were in the animal birth, there was no reason for you to understand yoga. Who knows? I mean, these people, they just go on and on. What is yoga? What is yoga?
Union.
Hmm?
The yoke.
Union. Union of... Union means it has to be union of a few things. What is union about? Union of what?
Mind,
body,
spirit.
Union of mind, body and spirit. What does that mean?
Self.
No, no. When you say union of mind, body and spirit, how do you explain that sentence, union of mind, body and spirit? What does that mean? What are we uniting? What is it that's not united with what? What is separated, where it is separated, and what are we trying to unite in that sentence?
Your kosas, like your layers, the seer in the center, your mind, your intelligence, your body.
Yeah.
All those things, unite those things, bring them all in the line.
I keep wanting to say mind and spirit.
Hmm?
Like your ego and your spirit.
Make it one. Okay.
This is so kind of awful.
You know, the word yoga, it comes from this Sanskrit root word yuj. Yuj, that's the root word. Every Sanskrit word, or at least 95% of the Sanskrit words, are derived from root words. The word yuj, according to the dictionary, has almost like 35 to 40 meanings, depending on the context. Okay. One of the meanings, as Jean said, is yoke. Is to join two things together. That's yoking them together. Another meaning is being in the state of samadhi, when the mind is fully controlled. That's another meaning. Okay, so for now what I am going to do is to ask you to take that meaning for our purposes, not yoke. And I'll tell you why later on. Okay? We'll put that on hold for now, for the time being. When we come to the right spot, we'll talk about why we need to think of yoga as not yoking, but as being in the state of samadhi. Because samadhi is our purpose, is our goal. And that's one of the meanings of yuj. So why not stick to that meaning rather than something else which may or may not apply for now? Is that okay? Okay, so we'll come to that. Okay, so now, what it says is that here now I am going to start explaining the concepts or the discipline or the knowledge of yoga. Anushasanam means discipline or knowledge or something that follows something else in that sense. Okay, so that's number one. Here, and you can, you know, you have access to all these slides, I guess. So you can later on you can refer to them as needed. This sutra number two is probably the most important sutra in the entire text because it defines yoga. And because it is defining yoga, that's one sentence I would like you to memorize in Sanskrit. If it's okay with you, so I would like you to repeat it after me. Okay? Yogash, chitta, vritti, Nirodha. Okay, one more time. Yogash.
Yogash.
Chitta.
Chitta.
Vritti.
Vritti.
Nirodha.
Nirodha.
That's the sentence which defines yoga, as yoga is the controlling of the fluctuations that are happening in the mind. Vrittis. Okay. So yoga, that's the first word. Chitta is the mind. Mind field, they call it mind field. And I'm going to explain what that mind field is. That's the chitta. And vritti is all the changes, all the constant chatter, clutter, everything that goes on in the mind. That's called a vritti. And nirodha is cessation or subduing or controlling, etc., etc. Those are the meanings of the word nirodha. So chitta vritti nirodha is the main definition, it's the goal of yoga, the practice of yoga, that through the practice of yoga you can attain a state where the mind is fully, completely still. That means it is not agitated anymore. It doesn't go through all the perturbations anymore. Okay? Very still in the mind. And then what he says is that once you are able to... Oh, this is another... And I'm going to talk about that. I'll come back to that slide. But let me go through the definition of these four sutras, then we'll come back. So the definition of yoga is that when you are able to control the mind, you are able to still the mind. Chitta vritti nirodha. And then the next sutra is... At that time, when you are able to control the mind, you are able to rest in your own true nature. Okay? I will explain what that means now. So, what that means at a high level is that if you are able to calm and still the mind, you can call yourself self-realized. You have realized your own true identity. You have realized who in essence you are. Okay? That's the number three sutra. The number four sutra is that if you're not able to do that, if your mind is not calm, if you're not able to still the mind, then your mind is completely in charge and that's going to take over. Okay? And when the mind is in charge, all it does is it only follows what's happening in the mind through the ego, and it's in a state of mess. Okay? So, Patanjali says, guys, you have a choice. What do you want to do? You want to control the mind and be peaceful, or you want the mind to control you and be miserable? Take your pick. All right? That's in essence what he's saying. Now, how do you control the mind? That's what he's going to talk the whole thing over. But these commentators say that, you know, it's a good idea to first of all understand what the mind is all about, how the mind works, how it functions. Before we can control anything, before we can still anything, we need to understand what it is all about, right? How it is working. So, what they say is that, you know, that to understand the mind, let us think of the mind as a composite of four different functions. Four functions. What are these four functions? What does the mind do?
Automatic stuff. Like it controls our automatic actions.
That's called the motor actions, or so to say, right? Mm-hmm. So that whole function, and there are other things associated with that, that's called the mind itself. That's called the manas. Okay? Cognitive mind, you can call it. Okay?
So the mind is comprehends, right?
Comprehends, yes.
It's also subject to misapprehension.
Mm-hmm.
So misapprehension, imagination, deep sleep, and memory. Are those what you're looking for?
No.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's coming later. No, we're just talking about the functions of the mind. What does the mind do? So, one is cognitive function, right? Cognition. Cognition means what? Through the five senses we are receiving input, and that's going to the mind. Without the mind, the eyes are useless, right? Without the mind, the ears are useless. So, it's the mind which is doing the cognition. So, that's one thing. And then motor action is the other aspect. And then,
I'm sorry, I thought you were asking us. I was just thinking about emotions.
Yeah, emotions. Feelings. That's fine. Yeah, emotions. Yeah, that's part of the mind. Emotions, feelings, and those are the kind of things. Those are all clubbed under one function called the manas in Sanskrit, which means the cognitive mind. You can call it just one. Okay, that's one function of the mind. What is the other function of the mind? There are four total. I already gave you the hint. Four. We have to add up to four. What else does the mind do? The second function of the mind, it's called the intellect. Intellect, the one which discriminates, which makes you pick among multiple choices that you have, which analyzes, which synthesizes things, which is the more intellectual work. Okay, so you have received information from the five senses, then you have to decide what you want to do. Okay? So that's called the intellect. Okay? Now, what's the third function of the mind? How does the intellect function? Everything functions based on the memory that we have. Memory. So every experience in life gets recorded in our memory. And it's the intellect's job to dig into the memory and then make decisions. Okay? So that memory is the third function. What's the fourth function of the mind? It's called, in English it's called ego. Anybody heard the term ego?
Yeah.
Ego. So those are the four functions of the mind. What does the ego do? It gives us an identity. Ego's function is to tell, I am a yoga student, I am a yoga instructor. Okay? But the ego does a little more than that. In addition to giving us an identity, it also adds labels to that identity. That's ego's beautiful job. I am the best yoga teacher. I am absolutely useless. I am miserable. I am the richest person. I am the most smartest person. All these labels of good, bad, ugly, handsome, all these labels are put by ego. Okay, that's what its function is. It does that beautifully. So every experience in life gets labeled. Every experience. By the ego. Every moment we are going through an experience in life, right? Right. For example, at this very moment, we are going through the experience of learning about Patanjali. Okay? So it's going to get recorded in our mind as a pure memory, first of all. So there are multiple components of what's getting recorded. One is the pure memory of the experience. What's the pure memory? That this class was held on such and such date with so many people, the weather was so and so, the temperature was such and such, and this was done by an instructor who came from Morrisville, and etc., etc. His name was so and so. That's the pure memory part. What does the ego do? It's going to add an element of likes or dislike, love or hate. I liked the experience, I hated the experience. I loved it, I disliked it. Okay? Those are the kind of labels that it was a beautiful experience, it was a miserable experience. I would never have to do anything with this instructor again, you know. Those are the kind of words that ego is going to put in there. The other thing ego is going to put in there is another statement which says, I liked it enough so that I want a repeat of that experience. Or, I hated it so much I never ever want to have a repeat of that experience. Okay? So those are the kind of information that get embedded in our memory based on every single experience. Okay, so three things get embedded. Pure memory, likes and dislikes, and a desire to have a repeat or not to have a repeat of that experience. So those are the three very commonly mentioned labels that are put in our memory bank. Everyone get that?
Could you repeat that again?
So one is the pure memory. Mm-hmm. Second is likes or dislikes, whether we liked it or disliked it. The third is a desire for a repeat, etc. Okay? A desire to repeat that experience. If we have a cup of coffee for the first time, the experience would be we had a cup of coffee on such and such date. Ego is going to put a label, I loved it. Oh my God, it was so nice. And then it's going to put a label, oh, I wish I can have it again. Okay? That desire is going to be there. And then what happens after that? Because you had liked it, you want a repeat of it, next time you will again have it. Again the same thing, you know, repeat that. And you repeat it more and more times, it becomes a habit. Then you can't live without it. Then if you don't have coffee, you get a headache. Okay, but that's how all these things function in the mind. So to understand how these four function, you know, I always like to tell a little kind of a story that I have kind of put together, anecdotal kind of story. So let's say at the end of the day, you know, when you finish work, you're coming home, you come home, and then you know, most likely you're going to be a little hungry at that time after the whole day's work. And so you might be wandering toward the kitchen. As soon as you go close to the kitchen, you start smelling something, and it smells nice. Okay. And so that cognitive function, that's what we are engaging now. All the senses are getting engaged. That's the mind's function. So the mind is recognizing that sense of smell, and that leads you to the kitchen area, and on the kitchen counter you see something, so the sense of sight is engaged, and you what do you see there? It's a piece of cake sitting there. Okay? And then your inclination is to engage the sense of touch, because you want to dip your finger in that cake and feel its texture and, you know, what it feels like. Okay, that's the normal tendency. So you dip your finger, and what's the next sense that you want to get engaged in?
Taste.
Taste. You want to put it in your tongue, on your tongue, and then find out what it tastes like. When you, having done all that, you have all the information about that piece of cake. And now it's decision time. What's the decision? What are the choices?
Eat it or don't eat it.
Eat or not eat it. Very obvious choices. And what we said was that there's another function in the mind which is going to make a decision. What's that function?
Intellect.
Intellect does the decision making. But what happens is, in our current state of the mind, the way things are structured inside the mind, the intellect, unfortunately, is unable to make independent decisions because it has its own boss. It thinks the ego is its boss. So it's going to actually approach the ego for permission to do something. So as soon as mind gives us all this information, it says, boss, boss, knock, knock, what? You know, I have to make a decision, please guide me. The ego says, oh, it's very simple, let me look into the memory. Like I said, every information is in the memory, and all the decisions have to be made based on what's in the memory. Otherwise, you have nothing to compare against, right? So it goes into the memory, and it's pulling up information, and it says, ah, I find it. 1 week ago, we had the same cake, and then it reads the label, divine. So it had labeled the experience as divine experience. Ah, no problem. I read the label. Go ahead, tell the mind, do the motor action, do whatever is needed. Comes back to the intellect. Intellect says, ah, I am the intellect. I have to make some private investigation before I tell the mind what to do. And where do we do the investigation? Memory, right? It goes for the memory in search and, oh, I find something related. What is that? My visit to the doctor a few days later, a day or so later. Blood work. What does the blood work say? High level, dangerously high levels of cholesterol in my blood. Dangerously high levels of cholesterol. At the suggestion of the doctor, I had to see a nutritionist, dietitian. And what does the dietitian say?
No cake.
No cake, because it was going to harm you further, and you're so close to having a heart problem, one cake might trigger it, who knows. Okay, so now the intellect is highly alarmed. Boss, 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 that's what I find. I just did this investigation, I'm not supposed to eat the cake. Guess what the ego says? You're the most stupid idiot. Can't you read the label? Read the label. It says divine. One piece of cake. Can one piece of cake kill anybody? Are you stupid enough to let go of this beautiful opportunity? Okay. And guess what happens? Well, we all know the story after that. But this is how the mind functions. That's the only thing I want to bring about. Is the functioning of the mind is currently, in most cases, controlled by the ego rather than the intellect, which is the real intelligent being. Okay? So, the focus of the Yoga Sutras, the entire discussion, is eventually geared toward all the practices which will make the intellect stronger and the ego weaker. That's the whole purpose of yoga. That eventually we want to make the ego, kind of put the ego in its place. Okay? And not let it be the decision maker, but just to give us an identity. Ego should tell me at this very moment my identity is that of a mother. And then pass on the baton to the intellect. That intellect decide what you want to do as the mother. Ego will tell you, I am the yoga student at this time. And then pass the job to the intellect. That's how it should be. So the whole purpose of yoga practice is to make the ego subservient to the intellect rather than being the master of the intellect. That's the whole job. Okay? So, So this is the picture that might again show the same thing. I have shown those four functions, the mind, intellect, the ego, and the memory. Okay? Do you have this picture in your slides or no? Okay, so as you can see, there are five senses I've shown: sense of hearing, touch, smell, etc. And then all these things, they lead to the mind. The mind is connected with the intellect, but the ego is connected with both the memory, intellect, and the memory. So ego can go into either one. Obviously, they're connected. Now, what it's saying is that when the mind is under control, then the seer rests in its own true nature. What does that mean now? What's that statement? What do you make of this statement? That's number three sutra. Does it make any sense at all?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, the seer is always there, right? And it's always, like, in its own nature, I would think, right? So, I don't understand what that means, really.
Right. What do you understand by the term seer?
Self.
Right.
So, it's basically saying that if you can get to the point of realizing the self, you won't have these other influences, and you'll do what is inherent to the self outside influences. That's the way I'm taking it. So, like, where you can push that ego down, and instead of having the outside influence of, oh, but it tastes really yummy, and one piece isn't going to hurt me, you're going to look at it and say, but that was one piece today. There's another piece another day, another, and you're going to look at it as in, this isn't good for me, I shouldn't do that.
Right. Very good. So the seer is the self, like you said. What is the self? Self is given different names, like in Sanskrit it's called Atma, okay, or the soul, or the self, etc. Okay? Those are the different terms. The technical term that Patanjali uses for seer is Purusha. Okay, we have heard that term before, right? Purusha. And what's the counterpart of Purusha? Counterpart?
Prakriti.
Prakriti, okay. Prakriti is everything that's not self, okay? So all this on the left side is all prakriti of the dotted vertical line. Everything is prakriti. So the mind, body, intellect, thoughts, emotions, everything is a part of prakriti. And remember, the other thing that we need to understand is prakriti has no consciousness of its own. The only entity that's conscious is Purusha. You've heard that before, right? The only entity that's conscious is Purusha, but they are in proximity with each other. And it is this proximity which allows the intellect to borrow that consciousness and function in its life. Okay? So some commentators call it borrowed consciousness, some call it reflected consciousness, depending on who you're reading. Okay? Now, this concept of Purusha and Prakriti is what has been borrowed by Patanjali from the Sankhya philosophy. That's what I wanted to mention. Okay? The concept of Purusha and Prakriti originally was given to us in the Sankhya philosophy. It's a more ancient philosophy. And the Samkhya philosophy also tells us that we actually, you know, in addition to all this intellect, mind, memory and all that, and the senses, we have a total of, we are a composite of 23 total elements. 23 elements. Okay. Have you heard of that before? Okay, so let me see if I can just write down so you have an idea. So what are the 23 elements? Number one is the intellect. We talked about that. Then the ego. Then the mind. And then we get into the five sense perceptions. Which are the sense perceptions of? Taste, touch, smell, sound, sight. Right? Five sense perceptions. Then we have five sense organs. What are these?
Ears,
skin. Eyes, skin, and nose. Five sense organs. Okay? Then we have the five organs of action. What are these? Feet and legs. That's one. Hands and arms. Number two. Then, what are the other organs of action? Tongue. Tongue for speech. Number four, organs of elimination. And finally, organs of procreation. Okay, so these are the five organs of action. Okay, there are five more left, right? We are up to 18. So five more to make it 23. What are the other five, finally? Five elements. Which are the earth, fire, water, air, ether. Everyone got that?
Yes.
Okay, so these are the 23 elements that we are a composite of. This is all according to that philosophy called Sankhya. Okay? And Patanjali uses all these concepts in his presentation of concepts of yoga. Okay? Okay. All right, so now let's move on from here. What time do we have to finish here? Until noon. Do you have something immediately after that?
Lunch.
which is very important.
Which, depending on how it goes, is a yes or no?
Yeah. And the only question I have is, if I go five minutes over, is that okay?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, the way we are going, we don't know how what we will cover and, you know, how much, etc. Okay. So now. So then, after defining what yoga is, Patanjali goes into the definition of the five vrittis. Vrittis are what causes changes in the mind. You know, what we're talking about is calming or stilling what goes on in the mind. What goes on in the mind, Patanjali says there are five causes, so to say, or five ways you can make perturbation in the mind. Okay? So that's the one you were reading earlier. Five vrittis. Okay? So what he says here is the mental modifications are fivefold. There are five of them, and they each one of them could be either painful or not so painful. Okay, so that's the whole concept of the vrittis. It's called vritti is the fluctuations or changes that go on in the mind. All right, so that's in the sutra number 6, he just defines these five types of changes that go on in the mind. The first is the right kind of knowledge. Second is the wrong kind of knowledge. Third is imaginary knowledge. Fourth is knowledge gained through memories. And finally, through the sleep process. Okay? So whatever is the impressions that we are creating in the mind based on correct knowledge, wrong knowledge, imaginary knowledge, memories, and the sleep. Those are the five different categories of vrittis, he calls them. Vritti is the changes and the fluctuations in the mind. Okay? I'm not going to spend a lot of time because this can take me a while. Because I'm going to go back to some of the other concepts, and if there is time, I'll come back to this. I'm just trying to. So, but very quickly then, actually I should go through at least some of the basic concepts here. So the correct cognition or correct knowledge is again derived through three sources. Okay? So what are the three sources here? One is direct perception. So how can you get correct information for something? That's the idea, right knowledge. What is direct perception? Through the five senses. Okay? So if I'm looking at you, I know who you are, I know your name and a little bit more about you, but that's direct perception because I'm actually seeing it through my own eyes. Okay? As long as my ego doesn't clutter the whole thing, you know, it's the right perception. So anything that's perceived through the five senses, that's considered direct perception.
Is that before we label it?
Yes. Of course, the ego is going to label it right away anyway. Right. So what we're saying is direct perception is what is recorded before the labeling.
Before it's labeled.
Okay. And it determines the specific. Okay. It determines the specific. If I'm looking at you, I know specifically it's you. It's not just any general woman or any general male or human being or something. It's not that. So it's specific. Then the next way to understand something is through inference. So I have already in my mind, okay, an experience in the past. Let's say I had a conversation with Lindsay. Lindsay is your name, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say I had a conversation with you in the past and I have a good idea what you sound like. All right? So now, at some later point in time, I'm sitting in the room. In the next room, there is some conversation going on. Oh, it's Lindsay. How do I do that? I'm not looking at her. I'm not being here having a direct perception. But I am able to make a guess. It's called inference, based on my previous direct influence, my direct perception. That's called inference. A very common example of inference in the Indian context or in the ancient texts is given the understanding that there is fire when you see smoke. You probably have heard that analogy. If you see smoke at a distance, you know that there is fire there, because otherwise you cannot have smoke. If I'm looking outside and I'm seeing something bright there, I know sun is shining in the sky. I cannot see the sun, but I know that from my past experience. That's called inference. Okay. And then verbal testimony is again based on something that you trust. You can also get direct, good, you know, correct knowledge through somebody or something that you trust. If you trust the ancient scripture of, let's say, Yoga Sutras, then whatever the Yoga Sutra says, you believe that to be true. Okay? And there are other texts in the Indian context, there are texts like the Vedas. Have you ever heard the term Vedas? What are the Vedas?
They're ancient texts of various philosophy, like knowledge, thesis, medicine. That's like Ayurveda, for one, is right?
Yeah, they're sub. Ayurveda is a part of what's called Vedanga or a sub Veda. Okay, but there are four Vedas, ancient texts, four of them. Okay, and then Ayurveda and science of medicine, etc., etc. And there are other. Jyotish, which is, what is Jyotish? Foretelling something? What is it called in English? I forget.
Like a forecast or
no?
A psychic?
Something like that. Astrology.
Oh, astrology.
My mind sometimes gives up. Okay, anyway, so those are all subdivisions of the further divisions of the Vedas. Okay, and the last part of the Veda is called Upanishad. Have you heard the term Upanishad? In what context?
It's in a book. Is it in the Gita? Is it in the Gita? Do they talk about it in the Gita?
It's part of it, I think.
Is the Gita part of it?
Which one? Gita. Gita is a later introduction which contains some of the essence of the Upanishad, but it's not quite a part of the, not the original Upanishad. Yeah, Gita. Have you been studying the Gita also?
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet.
I have. Some people have. Sorry. I'm not there yet. I'm still working on that. I was going to say, I have
some interest. Yeah. So, when you start reading some of the concepts, these two will emerge as the most important yoga texts, Yoga Sutra and the Gita. That will come to light. And once you understand these two texts, you have a fairly good understanding of various aspects of yoga philosophy. Okay. They are very important. Okay. So we have three sources of correct knowledge. One is direct perception, the other is inference, the third is testimony through a text or through another source. For example, if you trust a yoga teacher or you're a spiritual teacher, then whatever the teacher says becomes your right source of information. Now, what is the next wrong knowledge? Wrong knowledge is obviously when you perceive something and it is not truly what it is supposed to be. And the most common example, again in the Indian context, all the text will tell you, is a snake in a rope. It's a very common example. Have you heard that? Snake in a rope? You familiar with that? Okay, well, it's like in the dimly lit evening, for example, when it's getting to be dark, but it's not quite dark yet. It's just small amount of light is there. You're walking on the road and you see something curled on the road and you run away out of fear thinking that it's a snake. It might bite you. And then as soon as you start running, there's another guy coming. He has a flash in his hands. He says, "Why are you running?" He says, "No, I see a snake there. I am afraid of the snake." He says, "Well, let me check." So he put the flashlight on it. It's just a piece of rope, but it looks like a snake. Okay, and that's all called wrong knowledge. It's based on something that you perceive and then you get wrong information based on that. Okay, that's called viparyaya in Sanskrit. Right? And just by imagining that it's a snake, you can be very afraid and run away and have all kinds of fanciful, fearful things just by imagination. Okay, the third is imagination, where you start imagining things not based on any reality. And these are common examples, like when you say the word time, you don't know what that really means. Time is a human concept, you know, it's not in essence what it is. The other word that most commonly is mentioned is God. You hear the word God, you start imagining things. Well, what is God? Is it somebody sitting up in the sky under the in the clouds, or somebody else? You know, what's God? Or all abstract nouns, for example, love, happiness. They are all the words will give you some imaginary thinking. Everyone has their own concept of these words. There is no reality associated with these words. Everyone will define love differently, happiness differently, and all the abstract nouns, they're all in that same category, imaginary. And of course, we are very good at imagining things. We pull up stuff which is deep-seated in our memory and start imagining things. Oh my God, I should have done this, I should have done that. I wish I could live my life one more time and I would have done this. All that imagination, we are, like they say, rampant imagination in our minds all the time. Then what is sleep, and how does sleep leave an impression in the mind? Again, sleep is when there is absolutely no support, no other support in the mind. At that point we are in a state of sleep. That means there is no cognition going on, there is no mental imagery going on, and then we are in a state of deep sleep at that time. But it, even that leaves an impression of vritti in the mind, in the sense that you at least have an idea whether you slept well or whether you did not have a good sleep. At least that impression is left. So that's the vritti created by the sleep. And memory, finally, memory, we have talked about it already. You know, memory is everything that we experience in life. It creates a memory in the mind, and then we can pull those elements of memory anytime. You know, either we have a trigger or we want to deliberately want to think about something. You can pull that stuff out. Okay, so that's all about the five vrittis. Then, so what's the objective of yoga? It's to still the mind, right? Still the mind so that these vrittis, they do not have any influence on us. Vrittis are these fluctuations of the mind. All right? So these five fluctuations of the mind, can keep the mind agitated, can keep the mind disturbed all the while. So now it comes to sutra number 12 and 13, etc. What it says is that how do you still the mind? He says by two things. The two Sanskrit words he uses are abhyasa and vairagya. Now what do these mean? Detachment, non-attachment, dispassion, those are the common translations. Very good, yeah. So, abhyasa is practice. So, practice of what? When you say practice of what?
I don't think practice yoga, but that has a lot of connotations, right? You know, the physical practice and then the, you know, concentration, dharana. So, I think all of those things.
All of them. Practice of the eight limbs of yoga. So, you're not isolating any one of them, but all the eight limbs of yoga you have to practice. All the eight limbs. See? That's abhyasa. And what's vairagya? What's dispassion or detachment or non-attachment?
Removal. Hmm? Removal of the senses, essentially. Yeah, control of the senses.
Control of the senses, you know. Basically, not being attached to the five senses, etc. Okay, there are two terms used, non-attachment and detachment. You understand the difference, right? What's the difference?
I don't understand the difference.
Non-attachment and detachment. Non-attachment, if you're not attached to a cup of coffee, non-attachment means I don't want to get attached. Detachment means you're already attached to the cup of coffee every morning. I want to get rid of that attachment now. Now you understand the difference?
Thank you.
So, the vairagya literally means to not attach yourself to anything whatsoever. But then if you are already attached, you have to detach first, okay? Then become non-attached. Okay? So that's vairagya. Dispassion is the other term used. What does dispassion mean?
Kind of not be attached to what,
right.
What happened.
Right. Right.
Like not having emotions.
Not having emotions attached to it. Yeah, right. Okay. So, so whatever effort you need to put into this whole practice is called the practice of abhyasa. Abhyasa is the practice. And the commentators, you know, they say that what the effort required in abhyasa is composed of these elements: zeal and enthusiasm, courage, steadfastness and patience, pursuit of spirituality, and an attitude of service. Now, these are all commentators, you know. These are not words from Patanjali or anybody, but these are either from Vyasa or even some of the other commentators. Okay. Now, stillness is the one-pointedness of the mind when it is without rajasic and tamasic vrittis. Do you understand these terms at all?
Yeah.
What is it? What is rajasic and what is tamasic?
Sloth and activity.
Hmm?
Sloth or restfulness, rajas and tamas is activity. Like
you're reversing the two.
Oh, sorry. So rajas is activity.
Yes.
Sloth is stillness or...
Sloth. So there are three gunas, right? Everyone knows now. I'm assuming you know the three gunas. What are the three?
Rajas, tamas,
and sattva. Sattva, rajas, and tamas, right? Sattva is all purity, is goodness, kindness, and positive attributes, positive values, etc. That's all called sattva. Rajas, like he said, is all action, ambition, gung-ho, you know. Can think of it as the type A personality, as they say. That's all rajas and desires, etc., etc. And tamas is all dullness, all lethargy, all, I like to add the word couch potato-ness, you know. All you want to do is to sit down and have a, watch a football game having a beer and potato chips and all that. You know, that's all you want to do. So that's all rajas and tamas. So stillness of the mind requires that we move toward sattva and diminish the influence of rajas and tamas. That's what it basically means. Okay. We move toward more dominance by sattva is what is required. Okay. Now, what is abhyasa? What is practice? This sutra is very important, and it really kind of gives us the definition of abhyasa. Okay, you must probably have seen this before.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. It's a very important sutra because it really defines what practice means. So it says three characteristics. What are the three characteristics now? Of the practice?
Long time,
yes.
Without interruption.
And the third one?
Devotion.
Hmm?
Devotion.
So, no interruption, very long time, and a sense of devotion, faith, trust, etc., etc. So, long time, dirghakala. What's long term mean? Are you sure? No, it's a serious question. Are you sure that in one lifetime you will attain the goal of yoga of stilling the mind?
No, it could be a lifetime.
It could be or it will be. It will be. But Patanjali says the goal of yoga is so tough. The job of stilling the mind is so difficult that you will not attain it in one lifetime. You will need multiple births before you can attain that. Okay, so it's
but
not.
It could be this one.
It could be. It could be, but in general, for 99.9999% of the people, it will be multiple lifetimes. There will be one in a billion people who will probably attain it in one lifetime. But that all depends on your samskaras. Okay? So that's long term. Uninterrupted means, obviously uninterrupted. That means you set your goal. Eventually it becomes 24 hours. You're living the life of yoga 24/7. Okay? That becomes uninterrupted. Otherwise, if you just want to think of the practical approach, you set your goal to practice twice a day, do it every single day, twice a day. No interruption, no gaps, no breakages. And then, finally, the whole practice should be done with a sense of faith, trust, devotion. You are committed to that practice because you are fully convinced of its value, of its need and requirement, and why you're doing it. And then just go with that gung-ho, you know, zeal and enthusiasm and trust. Just go for it. Okay? So that's the practice. Now, what's the definition of this term detachment or non-attachment? So, there are two grades of, you know, two levels of non-attachment he has defined. One is lower level and one is the higher level. Okay. What's the lower level of attachment? That's defined in Sutra number 15. So what it says is that the ability to disengage the mind from any attraction to the five senses, first of all. Okay, five senses. The translation says seen. When you see, in most of our yoga texts, when you see the word seen, it actually implies all the five senses: seen, heard, touched, tasted, and everything. That's the implication. Okay, it's just given the term seen just to include everything. And what is unseen?
Imagine.
Love. No, it's actually. The word, the term, the translation unseen is wrong here. You know, I've taken the translation by Swami Satchidananda, and it's not a literal translation. It is anushravika is the Sanskrit word. Anushravika means heard through some other sources, through ancient texts like the Vedas. Okay, what the Vedas tell us, so every Veda has two major subsections, you can call them. One is called the section of action. The other is called the section of knowledge. Action means ritualistic action, rituals. This first part of Vedas will describe all kinds of rituals. What are the rituals for? For gaining material gains. Things like ritual for gaining a herd of cows. Ritual for gaining some property. Ritual for gaining a husband or a wife. Ritual for gaining heaven. Ritual for gaining one of the higher states of being, a higher state of, you know, being after I die. They are called lokas or different stages of being. So those are all these statements, you know, in the Vedas in the first part. The second part of the Vedas becomes more wiser. It talks about wisdom, talks about intellectual knowledge. Where now, the first part it says you do this and do that, you will get there and you will get here. Second part says, don't listen to the first part. It's all useless because your goal eventually is to just gain your own understanding. You want self-realization. That's your only goal. You don't want to go to heaven. You don't want to go to any of the higher states of being. Because from there you have to come back again into human form and do the same tapasya again, same sadhana again. So why do you want to do that? Just aim for your ultimate goal of self-realization. Okay? So if you read the second part of the Vedas, it says, don't bother about the first part. It's useless. Okay? So, what it's saying is that detachment is defined as, first of all, completely being free of any attachment to the five senses, objects of the five senses. That's number one. That's the drashta part. That means what is available through the five senses. Anushravika means what is available from the Vedic ritualistic knowledge. Okay? Even that you should be completely detached from. You have no interest in gaining heaven. You have no interest in attaining the... You know, there are these supernatural powers that I talked about. They are mentioned in chapter 3. Okay? So, what they are saying is, you can get those powers, but you are not attached to those at all. They are a distraction. They are an impediment. They are an obstruction in the path of spiritual enlightenment. Don't be attached to them. They might come. But don't get your ego so high. Oh my God, I can float on water. I can walk on water. But that's what the text says. That by doing this and this, you can float on water. You can walk on water. Having done that, is your ego going to be so high that, oh my God, I am going to show the whole world, this is what I can do? That's a no-no. If you're attached to that, you're dead. You will not make any more progress from that, or you will fall down.
It's ironic. I said, gain these abilities and you have to not care about them.
Yes. Yes. That's what Patanjali says. Don't bother about them. They may happen, enjoy them, but don't get attached to them.
Is it like letting go of the expectations, letting go of all expectations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, what's the higher level of detachment? You see, like I mentioned, that initially, To get to this level of detachment, you need to bring dominance of sattva guna. Okay, as long as you're dominated by rajas and tamas, your desires are going to be very strong. Your five senses are going to be very active, and they are going to run after their objects of attraction. When rajas and tamas are dominant, therefore, your goal is to go in the direction of making sattva as more dominant and rajas and tamas less dominant, less and less, less and less. But that means you are still attached to the sattva guna. Okay? Now this sutra says the highest level of detachment comes when you don't even desire these three gunas. You go past the three gunas. You transcend the need to be attached to the gunas. That's what it says. That the supreme dispassion happens when there is cessation of all craving for the attributes of these three gunas. Because at that time, you have now realized your true nature. When you realize your true nature, you have no need for the three gunas. You have transcended completely the three gunas. You need the sattva guna to get there. Having gotten there, get past that. It's like you need the mind to go past the mind. You need the mind to transcend the mind. Alright? So that's the whole concept of the detachment, supreme detachment. Okay? Then I have skipped a lot of the sutras which have to do with the concept of Ishvara and God. And, that's a topic by itself. I mean, that can take, it usually takes me 2 hours to go through that whole topic. So I have eliminated that part. You can read it yourself on your own sometime. If you have questions, you can always ask me. Okay, but that there's a lot of discussion on the concept of God, Ishvara. Are you familiar with that in the sutras? Definition of Ishvara and all that. Right? Not quite. Does anybody remember the definition of Ishvara? No? Or have you not studied it?
I can give you one word, yeah.
Hmm?
I can give you one word for Ishvara, probably God, like the supreme being.
I know, but the definition in this sutras, how has Patanjali defined it? Mm. Okay. Let's not spend time on that. I think it's a little... So, that's why I skipped all those sutras in this presentation. And what I was going to do is to just read these, these obstacles to the path of attaining our goals of yoga. Obstacles to the practice of abhyasa. Okay, that's given in the sutra number 30. Okay? And I'm just going to read them. Without any explanation, you can understand, you probably understand these meanings. So do you want to read the sentence? Or you don't have?
Certainly. Disease, dullness, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sensuality, false perception, failure to reach firm ground, and slipping from ground gained. These distractions of the mind stuff are the obstacles.
So these are the obstacles to the practice of abhyasa, like we said. You know, these are... When you're on your path, when you're on the path, it's called sadhana. Have you heard the term sadhana? You're all familiar with that term, right? Sanskrit term, sadhana. So when you're on the path of sadhana, these are the obstacles that you can come across, and they will obstruct your progress. Okay? Disease, dullness, laziness. And you gain some ground and then you suddenly fall off your practice, and then you slip down, things like that. Okay? So these are the obstacles to your reaching the goal of yoga. And then these are the five accompaniments to those obstacles. When you have those obstacles, these are the things that also are likely to happen. So you want to read the next five? Okay, so your breathing can become very disturbed. You can breathe slow, heavy, very disturbed breathing, etc., etc. Distress, despair, etc. Okay, so these are the symptoms. And how do you get rid of all these? You know, basically it says you have to practice meditation eventually. Meditation is the goal of yoga. Okay, and on some object of meditation, and that's the whole concept of yoga is to meditate. Okay, and this one is another very good sutra. I just picked it randomly. It's number 33. It's how to kind of make the mind more pleasant. Okay, are you familiar with the sutra? Okay, very good, yeah. It's a very nice sutra. It gives us the way to make the mind more pleasant, I should say. Make the mind more peaceful. Okay, what does it say? It says, so you want to read that in English?
By cultivating attitudes of friendliness towards the happy, compassion for the unhappy, delight in the virtuous, and disregard towards the wicked, the mind stuff retains its undisturbed calmness.
Right. So, what it is saying is that you can, when in your social interactions, right, you can kind of look at everybody as being in one of the four categories. So there are four categories of people, so to say. Okay? What are the four categories of people? People who are happy, that's number one. People who have some unhappiness, some, you know, they are miserable, that's the second category. Third category, he says, are the people who are doing good, benevolent deeds. Good deeds, benevolent deeds. And the fourth category is people who are doing miserable, dirty deeds, basically, bad deeds. Okay? And now he says that you have to develop an attitude, different attitude to all each one of these four categories of people. Okay? So people who are happy, develop the attitude of friendliness, maitri. People who are happy. Okay? Not jealousy. The general tendency is to become jealous. Oh my God, this guy is so happy, he's so rich, and this and that, and all that. The second category is unhappy, people who have some suffering, some pain. Toward them, develop the attitude of compassion. Compassion, the other word is empathy, I guess. Empathy, I think, is a little stronger than compassion. Is that what you think?
Yeah, to understand how they feel.
Yeah, understand how others feel, so they can actually become more helpful in some sense. So that's compassion and or empathy for those who are suffering. And then, there's a distinction between happiness and mudita, which is kind of a delightful attitude. That if somebody is doing good deeds, encourage them out of that sense of delight. Yeah, this guy is doing good. Okay, encourage them. Be helpful. Okay, mudita. And then if somebody is doing bad deeds, indifference or overlooking them, you know, not being upset, not being compassionate, but at the same time, not being entangled, not being engaged. So kind of go over them, okay? Now, of course, there are other statements which say that eventually if somebody is being such a pest that you cannot ignore them, you have to do something about it, you know. That also comes up later. Okay, so this is what I had on the first chapter. Okay, like I said, I have skipped a lot of stuff from here. There's a lot of stuff. There's a big section on the concept of Ishvara, God, and then there's a huge section on the different stages of samadhi. Different stages of samadhi meditation, basically. Okay? And if there's time, I'll go through it very, very briefly. And we'll see how much time we have left. If at all, any. Probably not. Okay? What I want to do is to move on to the next set of slides. Okay, this is the beginning part of chapter 2. The very early part of chapter 2. So, again, Patanjali has, in chapter 2, like I said, he's going to give us the techniques or the practices that will help us attain the goal of yoga. Okay, so, in the first few sutras, he talks about these klesha. Have you heard the term klesha in Sanskrit? You've heard that, right? Klesha means suffering or afflictions or pain or in the modern terminology, you know, you say stress. Everything is stressful. Oh my God, this guy is causing me stress. That guy is causing me stress. Right? You all say that. Right? But talking of stress, let me just spend 2 minutes on this one, you know. What is stress, first of all? What is stress? Is there kind of a definition in mind?
I was waiting for Adrian to tell us. You're the most qualified.
Physical reaction. Hmm? Almost like a physical reaction to something happening in your environment.
What kind of reaction?
Like a physical reaction. Like
physical.
Your breath changes.
Why physical?
Like your breath changes. It could be.
Right.
Like shallow tension.
Okay.
In your body.
But that's the physical manifestation. Mm-hmm. But where is the origin of the stress? Is it the physical body or the mind? That's the question.
That's the mind.
It's the mind, right? That's what I wanted to bring out. You know, the origin of stress is in the mind. You know, we feel incapable of dealing with the present situation. In a sense, we feel threatened by the present situation. Whatever we are presented with. We are threatened by it and we feel incapable of taking care of it. That's what causes the stress, right? But then, you're absolutely right, it has physical, physiological manifestation. Your breathing can be haywire, your head and shoulder, neck and shoulder might start hurting, you might get diarrhea, you may have loose motions, all kinds of things happen, right? Those are all physiological manifestations of stress. But the main thing to understand is that stress is happening in the mind. That's the key understanding. And the next question that we always ask is, whose mind are we talking about? If I'm stressed out, whose mind is it? It's my mind, right? Now, whenever I say it's my mind, I'm talking about an entity that belongs to me. If it's my computer, it belongs to me. That's why I claim it to be my computer. If it's my pair of glasses, I own it. Okay? So it belongs to me. If it breaks down, who takes care of it? I do. If this computer breaks down, I take care of it. So if it's my mind, I own it. Who should take care of it? I should take care of it. I am responsible for it. But in general, who's responsible for my mind? Everybody else except me. It's everybody else who can influence the state of my mind except me. That's why we point fingers at everybody else. Gene is causing me stress. Point fingers at everybody else. Traffic is causing me stress. My kids are causing me stress. My boss is causing me stress. My co-workers are giving me a hard time. Why? You know, there's anybody in software here? Okay. You know, there is a term called outsourcing, right? In software, outsourcing. So what I like to say is that we have outsourced the control of our mind to everybody else. Okay, whereas the mind should be in my control. If it is in my control, can I ever be stressed? That's the question.
Not if you don't want to be.
Hmm?
Not if you don't want to be.
Exactly. Absolutely. You get that point? We are stressed because we choose to be stressed. It's by choice. If we decide not to be, like he says, if you don't want to be stressed, you don't have to be stressed. Ever. But that's what the definition of yoga is. Because it's happening in the mind, and what would you say the definition of yoga was? Stilling the mind. Stress is something that's happening in the mind. It's a vritti. It's one of the fluctuations of the mind, stress. And stilling the vrittis of the mind is yoga. So yoga by definition is stress management. You understand that? Okay? So stress is happening in the mind, and that's why we call it the stilling of that, what's happening in the mind is yoga. That's why yoga is stress management. So what Patanjali is talking about in second chapter is how to, first of all, understand what the stress is, what the kleshas are, and then what to do about them. Okay? So in the very first sutra, he says, there are three things you can do. First of all, he defines what Kriya Yoga is. Okay? And he says, tapa, swadhyaya, ishwar, pranidhana. You know these terms, right? You know these terms or no? Tapa, swadhyaya, ishwar, pranidhana. Where do they come later on? Niyamas. Now, five niyamas. Okay, so they are the last three of the five niyamas. Okay? What he says, these three represent what's called Kriya Yoga. Okay? And what the purpose of Kriya Yoga is this twofold purpose of Kriya Yoga. Okay, what it says is that this Kriya Yoga will help us minimize the obstacles, these kleshas. Obstacles is the wrong word. You know, I should change these words somehow. I should change them, change the word that I don't like. Because, you know, it gives wrong information in my mind. Like I said, I've used the translation by Swami Sachidananda. It's time to modify it slightly. So it says, minimize the kleshas. Klesha is suffering, not obstacles. Suffering can be obstacle, but that's not a good translation. Okay, and also it helps samadhi bhavana. That means your attitude towards sadhana, samadhi will improve. So these three practices of tapas, swadhyaya, ishvara pranidhana. So what is tapas? What does it mean?
I think about a fire.
Tapas is fire, but what does it mean in practical terms?
It's to exert yourself enough to...
Yes. Fire. Yes. Exert yourself. Go against the current. Try to swim against the current if possible. See how much exertion you need. Okay? Swim against the current. That means if you are addicted to this cup of coffee, can you give it up for a week? That's going against the current. Right? If you need 10 hours of sleep, can you try sleeping for 6 hours? That's going against the current. Okay? If you are fond of eating every single day, can you quit eating for a couple of days? That's going against the current. That all is called tapas. Really toughening up, hardening up, you know, making yourself so tough that you can withstand what they say, the dualities that life presents us all the time. If it's only when we are real tough that we can withstand these dualities of hot and cold, honor and dishonor, good and bad, ugly and handsome, all these things we are presented with all the time, we have to make ourselves tough. That's tapas. What is swadhyaya?
Self-study.
Self-study also implies study of the scriptures, because the scriptures are supposed to contain the ultimate truth of life, and once we know the truth, then we can understand ourselves much better. That's swadhyaya. And what is Ishvara Pranidhana?
Devotion.
A sense of utter devotion or surrender to this Ishvara. And like I said, Ishvara has been defined very specifically by Patanjali. So you have to go with that definition, not by your own understanding of what God is. It's a very specific definition. Okay? So, what are the five kleshas? This is what is defined in this sutra. Five kleshas. Does everyone remember the five kleshas?
I've seen them. I've seen them.
Yeah, go ahead, read them.
I heard ignorance, egoism, attachment, hatred, clinging, clinging to body life.
Okay, so let me just spend just a few minutes. We're running out of time. Okay. The main source of all suffering is ignorance. What does it mean when we say ignorance? Ignorance is all about not knowing who I am. It's not knowing my true identity. It's understanding things wrongly. It's identifying things which are not pleasant as pleasant, which are not real as real, which are not good as good, etc., etc. It's all wrong, opposite information. Okay, understanding this is my body is my real self. That's not the reality, but I misunderstand that. This mind is my real self. That's misunderstanding. All this is ignorance. Okay? And what does that do? When I don't know what my true reality is, when I'm ignorant, ego takes over. That's the first thing that happens. Ego is very smart. It takes over. It says, I have an opportunity. I can control everything now. Because this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Right? The Purusha is entangled with the whole this mind-body complex. Instead of looking backwards and at its own true self, it's looking outward. It's going attracted to this thing, attracted to that thing, through the five senses, through the mind. It's getting entangled. So when the Purusha is entangled, the ego takes over. Okay? And that becomes the cause of all suffering. Because ego, like I said earlier, it likes to put labels on everything. I like it, I dislike it. That's the third and egoism is attachment and hatred, likes and dislikes. Ego puts that label. Okay? And then eventually it leads to fear. The ultimate fear is fear of death, but we are afraid of everything in life. Every change that happens in life, we are afraid of it. It gives us fear. It gives us a sense of insecurity. Every change in life. When you're not married, you're insecure of whether I'm going to get married or not. When you are married, you're insecure. When I'm going to get rid of this person now. When you don't have a child, you're worried. You're fearful. If you have a child, oh my God, when is he going to grow out of this mess? Change. Fearfulness. Okay? Now, these are the five kleshas which are the cause of suffering for us. Alright? And then Patanjali actually goes into the whole concept of karma theory. Right? Karma theory means that we have a sequence of life, death and rebirth. That's the whole karma theory based on your karma. You know what karma is? It's all your samskaras basically, all your past impressions, everything that is stored in our bag of karma. And we are always carrying a bag of karma with us from life to life to life to life. Okay? So that's all that karma theory. And so then he goes into, this whole concept of understanding what this karma does to us, right? But then he says that it's the ego which is the cause of all this suffering. Okay, suffering, first of all he says suffering is avoidable. Eventually suffering is avoidable. Okay? And that's the sutra number 16. Suffering, pain that has not yet come is avoidable. Now, what is the cause of this suffering?
Mind.
Read the sentence here. Can somebody read it?
The cause of that avoidable pain is the union of the siya, purusha, and the seen, prakriti, or nature.
Can you read it again?
The cause of that avoidable pain is the union of the seer and the seen.
Okay, now when I asked the question in the very beginning, what is yoga? You said union of the mind, body and soul. Okay?
So that's these things. That's these things, basically.
That's these things. So what he's saying is just the opposite now. Can you see the opposition? When you said yoga is the union of purusha and prakriti, right? He's saying that union of purusha and prakriti is the cause of suffering. That's what you want to avoid. You don't want the union of purusha and prakriti. Because if you do that, when the purusha is entangled with prakriti, it's causing all the suffering because ego takes over. You want the ego to be subdued, and that can only happen when you separate the two, not unite the two.
I said a line, by the way.
Hmm?
I said a line at one point. A line that's different now.
Somewhat different, right? You're right. But we want separation. So what we want is isolation of Purusha and Prakriti. That's the goal of yoga, isolation. It's called, the term Patanjali uses for that isolation is Kaivalya. And the fourth chapter is titled Kaivalya Pada, the chapter on isolation. Okay? Because now we want to understand that, look, I am totally separate from this mind, body, intellect complex. I am not that. I am not that. If I am that, I am suffering, because then the ego takes over. Therefore, I don't want to be identified with this mind, body, intellect complex. Patanjali says that. I'm not saying that. Patanjali says the cause of suffering is the union between mind and between mind, body, and the Purusha. Okay? Because this Prakriti is a combination of these three elements, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. That's what it's saying here. Prakriti is a combination of sattva, rajas, and tamas. He uses the terms prakasha, kriya, and sthiti. They mean the same thing, sattva, rajas, and tamas. What's the purpose of this whole thing? Twofold. Purpose of prakriti is only twofold. One is to provide all the experiences of life through the five senses, through other means. First, provide experience, but eventually help get the soul liberated. That's apavarga. That's the word he uses here. So two purposes of prakriti is to provide experience of this life and eventually lead to total liberation. Okay? So that's the whole purpose of okay. I wanted to just now, here's my question. It's 5 minutes before noon. It will take me 2 minutes to explain this, and then maybe a couple other brief items. Is that okay?
Yeah.
5 to 7 more minutes? Okay. This is the sutra in which Patanjali introduces the 8 limbs of yoga. And I wanted to bring this to attention. It's a very beautiful and very important sutra which introduces the 8 limbs of yoga. Okay? So can you read the translation?
By the practice of the limbs of yoga, the impurities dwindle away and there dawns the light of wisdom, leading to discriminative discernment.
Okay. It's a very beautiful and a very pregnant sutra in terms of its depth of meaning. Okay. And I really want you to kind of dwell on the sutra in your own time later on. Understand the really depth of this sutra. Because what it says is that through the practice of yoga, all the impurities of the mind will go away. What are we talking about? Impurities of the mind.
When you let the ego control, take control.
But what's the impurity? Like what?
Like all the labeling. All of the ego's labeling.
Labeling, yes. And things like, you know, when we talk of impurities, they all in the Indian context, in the ancient texts, they talk about 6 impurities, they say. They are lust, craving, that's number 1, anger, greed. Have you heard these terms?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, jealousy, arrogance, etc., etc. These are the 6 listed as enemies of the mind. They are called the impurities of the mind. And then you add to that list things like depression and, every negative stuff, basically. And then all the labeling that goes with it. It's all going to cause negative stuff, negative impact, it's all impurities of the mind. Now, when you are able to practice these eight limbs of yoga, Patanjali says that these impurities will eventually dwindle down. They will come down. That's number thing. One thing happens. When that happens, he says, the light of wisdom begins to shine through. See, right now, that light of wisdom is covered right now with the ego. Ego puts a big blanket on it. It doesn't want you to go through that light of wisdom. So when you are able to subdue these impurities, ego has very little to do because now it has nothing to work on because you've taken away its fodder, basically. When that happens, you're able to see that light of wisdom, which is the pure intellect, which is getting its light from the pure soul, pure consciousness. So when that happens, the light of wisdom will shine through. And then that will lead you to eventually to your full self-realization. That viveka khyatehe, last word is full self-realization. At that time you will know exactly who you are. You're not dependent. You're not identified with the ego, mind, complex. You are pure being, pure consciousness on your own. Nothing to worry about. And how? When does that happen? When you practice all these eight limbs of yoga. See? And what's the most important of these eight limbs of yoga? Meditation. Yoga means meditation. There are 195 sutras in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. How many are for asana practice? Three sutras for asana. What's the meaning of the word asana?
Comfortable seat.
Comfortable seat. Very important to recognize that. Asana just simply means comfortable and steady. Sitting posture. All these warrior poses and inversion poses and headstand and shoulder stand and handstand, they all came later. Much later. But then rather than giving them a separate name, they all decided to give it the same name as asana. Literal meaning of asana is a sitting posture. Not a standing or an inverted posture. Asana. It has to be comfortable and very steady. Okay? So you have to just kind of understand these things. And what's the purpose of yoga? Sit and meditate. Because that's all what Patanjali wanted. He didn't want you to do inverted poses and all that. He probably didn't even know about them. All he said was, sit comfortably, sit and meditate. Do some pranayama. He talks about pranayama quite a bit. And then sit and meditate. Because that's all he wants us to do, sit and meditate. It's only through meditation that we can attain the goal of yoga. Only through meditation. So yoga means meditation, nothing else. So in terms of practice, he has given asana, pranayama and meditation. I always like to add, look, when we do practice, we might do first asana and then pranayama and then meditation. But in terms of priority, it's just the opposite, reverse. Number one priority should be assigned to meditation, number two to pranayama, and number three to the asana practice. So if you have a half hour of practice, allocate 15 minutes to meditation, 10 minutes to pranayama and 5 minutes to asana practice. Not the other way around. Okay, I've run out of time now. I have many other things that I wanted to talk about, but it's good. I hope you get something out of this discussion. But any questions that come up before we let you go for lunch?
That's a loaded question.
I'm just asking if there are any further questions. Anything that comes to mind?
I just think it's interesting that there's so much focus now on the physical practice.
On the?
When I think about yoga, I don't first think about meditation.
But isn't that the Western society that does that?
How we've done that. Mm-hmm. We've done that together.
Yoga, when you hear the word yoga, the only thing that comes to mind is meditation. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. So that's what Patanjali wants us to do. That's the only way we can attain the goal of yoga, the objective of yoga. Yoga means meditation. Literally. It comes from the word yuj, which means to be in the state of samadhi. Samadhi is meditation. Okay? So, let's once again close the eyes. Sitting up comfortable. In closing, we'll recite Om once now. So take a deep breath in. Once again, do this closing invocation to Sage Patanjali. So you can either read the screen or close the eyes. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Patanjalim pranjaliran tosmi. Om asatoma sagamaya tamasoma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Please lead me from unreal to the real, from darkness to light, and from the fear of death, lead me to the knowledge of immortality. Peace, peace, peace. Thank you all very much. Thank you all. Thank you, Dharma, for this wonderful opportunity. I hope you found it helpful, useful. And I'll be, you know, like I said, I have